up our podcast this week, Jake Gyllenhaal drops by to talk about his new film, Nocturnal Animals, while I get so dazzled by the hair of Doctor Strange star Mads Mikkelsen that I ask him the stupidest question of all time. All that and more on the movie podcast that enjoyed the last episode of The Great British Bake Off, but didn't expect the body count to be quite that high. Weird. Hello, pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to the Empire Podcast. Forgive me today for not being my usual ebullient self, but Bake Off has gone. Great British Menu is going. Hotch has been kicked off, or kicked himself off, Criminal Minds. What's the point, frankly, of carrying on? There is nothing left. All is dread. All is despair.
What?
This week I'm joined by two colleagues of such lethal cunning, both of whom have plenty of great TV shows keeping them going over the next few weeks. First up is our... First up is our geek queen, a lady whose favourite show, My Two Shirtless Brothers, is still going strong in its 54th season. Please welcome to the podcast, Hamilton O'Hara. Sorry. Helena Hamilton. Sorry.
Hello.
Hamilton O'Hamilton. How are you?
Close enough.
Close enough. Got there in the end.
He's back in London, people. Be on the lookout. Lin-Manuel Miranda is in this very city.
He is.
There's an appreciable uptick in the genius level around. Yeah. Can you feel it?
How's he getting around town? Do you not have a Hamilton reference in response to that? I'm sure you do.
I mean,
he's not throwing away his oyster. He is not.
That's
no,
not
that's
thing.
The only thing I know from Hamilton.
I know it is. You need to learn another line, dude.
My wife. Oh. My wife played. Yes, my wife. Oh, drinking game. My wife played. She listens to the soundtrack.
And yes, she
played
she does.
The first five songs for me the other day.
Yeah. Good. It's a start.
Yeah, I like the beats and the shouting. Next up we have our art house guru, a man whose favourite TV show is The Great Bulgarian Existential Bake Off, which is a lot like the British Bake Off, but it's black and white, subtitled, and has nothing but scorn for Hollywood. It's Phil Dissemblian. How are you?
Good.
Yeah?
Yeah. That was a surprisingly morose opening.
I'm in a funk, man. I'm in a funk. Bake Off's gone.
You've got a slam dunk defunct, Chris. I mean, come on.
Bake Off is gone.
Do you feel
Bake
sad
Off
about gone. It?
I feel really sad about it. It won't be on our screens next year. It won't be on Channel 4, you know, until 2018. It won't have Mel and Sue, who are brilliant at what they do. It won't have Mary Berry. You know, it's got Paul Hollywood, but...
Yes.
It's not the same.
It's just one ingredient. It's like eating raw flour. Like, it just doesn't, you know, you need the sugar and the butter and the eggs in there.
I'd never seen it before this season, but I just got so bored of people talking about Victorian sponges.
What is even wrong with you? They barely talked about Victorian sponges.
In The Office.
Fair enough. There's nothing, but I mean, I don't know of many more interesting topics than a Victoria sponge. I mean, and even last night, Mary Berry was advocating buttercream in the middle. What? Cream or GTFO, quite frankly?
No, GBBO. Yeah.
I was appalled. Appalled.
I made a cake.
Did you?
Last year.
Wow.
It was very successful. And it was a Victoria sponge. It was Sophie Dahl's Victoria sandwich recipe with raspberry jam.
Correct.
And an orange cream.
You cake explaining, Chris.
I just don't like strawberry.
Let me tell you, on the Great Bulgarian Existential Bake Off, you have none of these problems. Two major ingredients.
But that's because all they make is.
And ennui.
Oh, that's because all they make is dark rye bread.
Leave to die slowly over decades.
Yeah, they leave to get stale and then they, you know.
Okay.
Either it bakes on it. Or it doesn't bake.
That's just generic Eastern European accent.
It was kind of French.
Okay.
But I like to think that Jean-Paul, the character that I just created there, he. Obviously born in Paris. I think you'll find that was that was 14th arrondissement, I believe. That accent was sourced from.
That was very good. Oh, it's fancy, the 14th.
Is it?
Yeah.
And he moved to Bulgaria to pursue his dreams of becoming a sommelier.
A sommelier.
A sommelier.
Yeah.
Really?
Well, no, baking's a hobby.
Oh, I see. Wine is his life.
Wine is my life.
A Frenchman moves to Bulgaria to be a sommelier.
This it looks. It sounds it's to me like you just looked at the plotline of Ratatouille 2.
Very difficult industry to break into. It's not what you know, it's who you know.
What's going on?
I'm sorry.
Anyway.
Hi.
And Hotch is leaving Criminal Minds.
Who's Hotch? What's that?
Hotch is... Do you not know
Never
this?
Mind.
Do you not
Never
know
mind.
This story?
No.
Never
no,
mind.
Thomas Gibson, the long reigning star of Criminal Minds, the great FBI procedural show that is currently in its bit like Supernatural 54th season, was fired from the show recently for getting involved in an altercation with a writer on set. He was directing an episode and he got involved in an altercation with a writer and is alleged to have kicked said writer and then was fired from the show. As if that's a fireable offence. Apparently, kicking someone is... I mean, if that's wrong, then I don't want to be right.
What is... What potential scenario? What are you doing? Chris is kicking me.
I'm kicking you under the desk.
Stop it.
You're a much bigger man than I, Phil.
What potential scenario would involve a star of a show having to kick a writer? It seems like it might have escalated quickly. I don't like that adjective.
Thank God nobody had a trident. It'll be fine.
Okay.
All right, do we have a question?
Please.
Okay, the question's from Facebook, and it's from Carl Jackson. And he asks, in essence, because I haven't got it written down, who's our favourite Scream Queen? Right, should we do this on three?
Okay.
Okay? Because we're all going to say the same name, right?
Sure.
Okay.
Okay. So, three, two, one.
Is Jamie Lee Curtis? Oh.
What?
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 What did you say?
Jamie Lee Curtis, obviously.
What did you say?
I said Isabelle Huppert.
You're a parody of yourself.
Did you say Jamie Lee Curtis as well?
No, I said Linnea Quigley.
Oh. Well, that wasn't very good.
Well, it worked out pretty well. I thought we hadn't rehearsed that in any way, shape or form, so that worked out pretty well. Okay. Yeah, Jamie Lee Curtis.
It's Jamie Lee Curtis.
It's Jamie Lee Curtis.
The very term is basically a description of her.
Mm.
Yes.
Isn't it? You know?
Well, is it not... Her mum.
Her mum, but her mum actually only really had one scream. I mean,
yes.
It was the scream heard around the world,
but
if you will.
But it's the Scream Queen, not the Screams Queen.
Mm? Oh.
Mm, I don't know.
But it definitely runs in the family, like a talent for screaming.
Did you
know?
Just describe it as a scream that was heard around the world?
I did, yes.
Yes.
I wonder what it wasn't, though,
because Hitchcock obviously made ensured that it was kept secret.
Yeah, but eventually it was heard around the world,
It went viral.
You just couldn't walk in the middle of the film and then hear it. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
I wonder how you'd look after your voice if you're screaming all day. Like, do you have to gargle a lot of honey or whatever? You know, because it's all from the throat. Like, the diaphragm doesn't come into it so much. So, you know.
It is a challenge. I mean,
I would imagine
my choice
it would be a challenge.
Would be Shelley Duvall for
Ooh,
this.
Oh, yes. No, that's for The Shining,
purely because of The Shining.
Yeah.
She didn't have... Jamie Lee Curtis' body of screaming work.
Sure.
She did have this one performance.
The body, if you will.
And what she was put through to by Kubrick to get there is just brutal.
True.
So I think she deserves at least an honourable mention. But yeah, like as you were saying, she was, I think the scene with the baseball bat, she'd shot 140 odd times and she ran out of tears.
Yeah.
Which sounds like the subtitle for the Great Bulgarian Existential Bake Off. We've run out of tears.
So we're going to have to use baking soda.
Yes. Well, she had to have extra water just to keep herself. Kubrick was trying to turn her into a giant human raisin just by leeching her of her essence over a period of weeks and weeks and weeks.
So
of
he really was after their bodily fluids. Is that
pretty
what
much.
Okay, well.
Yeah. But he wouldn't let anyone on set talk to her, encourage her, give her any feedback. Brutal bubble of hell that he put her in. And as a reward for this, she got nominated for a Razzie, which seems astonishing.
Shelley Duvall,
for that film.
I'm not a big fan of her in that film.
Are you not?
Oh no. My goodness. I do think that I hope that's going out of style, and I don't think it is. That idea that directors put especially women through hell for, you know, to reach a certain point. I mean, famously, Kim Basinger in 9 and a Half Weeks was just put through the ringer completely because her director didn't trust her to get to the performance otherwise. I don't know, maybe you should hire actors, guys. You know, I just feel like, and then trust them to act. It's just a radical notion. Hey, I'd like to put in a word for Faye Ray, the original, if you will, for King Kong. She was obviously told when she was hired, at least so the legend goes, that she'd be working opposite the tallest, darkest man in Hollywood. She thought Clark Gable. She was wrong. It was, of course, King Kong.
Yes.
So that there was some impressive screaming
work. The
first
Scream Queen, would you say?
The first Scream Queen? Well, I don't know. I mean, I'm not well-versed enough in my very early cinema to know if there were some... I mean, there was some amazing screaming in the silent era, but of course we can't really judge them on their decibels there. But in terms of scream faces, the silent era had some greats.
She spent virtually the whole shoot in the palm of this one ape hand. That was all she saw of King Kong.
Yeah.
So she called her autobiography On the Other Hand, which I like. Of course, nowadays she'd obviously be working closely with Andy Serkis, who would be just lifting her, I guess. But yeah, that's a good pick.
Yeah.
That's a very good pick.
What else we got? I like Neve Campbell.
Neve Campbell, yeah.
Yeah.
The queen of Scream, if you will.
She's a literal Scream queen. Very good. There are a couple of actresses who... Because do you want to confine it to people who've just done one movie? Mm. Or, you know, do you have to earn the sobriquet over a couple of movies? Like Jamie Lee Curtis did a bunch of horror films, you know, obviously the ones with John Carpenter, but also movies like Terror Train, and Prom Night. But I'm going to throw, you know, I said Linnea Quigley at the beginning, that, you know, she's a star of movies like Return of the Living Dead, where she doesn't necessarily do much in the way of screaming. She does take her clothes off in a cemetery. That's neither here nor there. But there's also there's Barbara Crampton, who's the star of Stuart Gordon's H.P. Lovecraft movies, so Reanimator and From Beyond. Mm-hmm. She does a hell of a lot of screaming in those. And she's kind of been rediscovered or reconfigured, if you will, by the current horror wunderkinds, people like Adam Wingard. So she's in Your Next. And so she's been rediscovered by those people, which is really, really great to see. So, yeah, but, you know, for me, it's someone who's not just screaming in one film, but screaming across a body of work.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, why should it just be Scream Queens? What about Scream Kings? Surely there are blokes out there, you know, who are equally being chased around in the final act of horror movies by evil things. And why shouldn't, you know, they're screaming as well. Bruce Campbell's got a hell of a scream on him. A hell of a pair of lungs. He does a good old yell. A good, Sarah Berry in Evil Dead 2, who plays Annie. Her scream is so distinctive that I swear, every now and then if you watch a football match on TV, you'll hear a woman yelling in the audience. Usually, weirdly enough, it's Spurs. I think there's a... And I keep thinking it's her. It's a very distinctive scream of kind of... Very high-pitched. Uh-huh. Very, you know.
Here's a question. Do they have to be horror movies? Can you include thrillers?
Yeah. So, Halloween's coming up, I guess that's why we're...
Yeah, of course. But,
Maybe for horror.
I mean, I guess you could say Black Swan is a horror movie.
Yeah.
But I think Natalie Portman qualifies
for
that, in a way.
Yeah.
Do we think? Or is you saying that that's to find Scream Queens?
How much screaming is in Black Swan? How much actual...
You need to do actual screaming. It can't be metaphorical screaming.
I would say...
Howl of despair.
I mean, screaming into the void doesn't count, is that what you're saying?
I mean, obviously, yeah, the great Bulgarian existential bake-off is full of voiceless screams, which is really weird. They open the oven and it's just...
It's a hell of a program. Would Micah Monroe in It Follows count as a scream queen?
Yes.
She
doesn't scream a lot.
In the movie.
Does she not scream at all?
Not as far as I'm aware. No.
I think she does, doesn't she?
It's hard to tell because I was screaming.
Yeah, maybe that's it. But she's very, you know, she gets it together, I'd say, fairly early on. It's interesting because obviously the concept of a scream queen, obviously the title Scream Queen derived from people in the late 70s and early 80s slasher movies, people like Jamie Lee Curtis and PJ Souls, and people like Adrian King from Friday the 13th 1 and 2.
Maybe Heather Langenkamp in the Nightmare Before Elm Street.
Oh, prequel.
It's
prequel,
a fun musical.
Ooh, I like that. Yeah, so it derived from people like that, from the concept of the final girl, if you will, in movies. But again, we were talking about people who had a body of work, you know, people who would appear in one, two, three, maybe four of these movies of horror films. And I think that the modern actor tends to want to avoid that.
Yeah.
So Micah Monroe hasn't really been in another horror film besides It Follows.
Unless you count The Guess, which I think was before.
That is true.
An interesting one. Yeah. Kevin Lehane on Twitter was having a discussion about genres last week. You know, is The Silence of the Lambs a horror or a thriller, for example? Mm-hmm. Now, for me, that's a full-on thriller because I think the police element and the sort of the matching of wits... Mm-hmm. makes it a thriller, but you can't deny there are definitely horror elements to it.
Mm-hmm.
And where do you kind of draw the line with some of these? Even Scream, is it a thriller or is it a horror? I don't know. I would
say Scream's a horror, but
I would
it's,
too.
It's interesting because you also have, for someone like, for example, Anya Taylor-Joy, who is in The Witch and Morgan and Split, Shyamalan Split, and you could argue all those are horror films. I don't know how much screaming she does in total all the way through them because she's not necessarily the person being chased. But that's interesting. There's someone who seems to be not running away from horror films.
Yeah.
That concept of horror films. I think it's really, really interesting.
Well, there's some great, great horror being made right now. So it's kind of interesting to see how the genre is developing. We may have some great new ones in future.
And of course, you also have this sort of subset of heroines in horror movies who don't scream and who are very, very, and they keep themselves together and they attack the threat. Laurie Cardill and Day of the Dead, for example, is absolutely not a scream queen. Sigourney Weaver in Alien, absolutely not a scream queen. So anyway, Jamie Lee Curtis.
Happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween, everybody. Do send us in your pictures of your favourite Halloween cakes to us at Empire. Email us at cakes@empireonline.com. If you want to have your question read out on the Empire Podcast, we are on Twitter as at Empire Magazine. You can use the hashtag Empire Podcast. In fact, you should use the hashtag Empire Podcast. We're also on Facebook, as Carl Jackson has discovered.
Yes.
Prolific sender of questions, Carl. Thank you for your question. We're on Facebook as Empire Magazine, and you can email us as well, podcast@empireonline.com. Okay, time now for our first guest. Doctor Strange opened this week in the UK, and I jumped at the chance to talk to the man playing its villain, the Great Dane himself, Mads Mikkelsen, he of Hannibal fame, he of Le Chiffre in Casino Royale fame, and he of Thomas Vinterberg's The Hunt fame, of course. All went well. I was fairly prepared. I did make a joke on Twitter about how I was underprepared and asked people for questions, but that was a joke. I had everything together. I knew what I was going to ask. Then he walked into the room with the most perfect hair I've ever seen, and it just threw me. Completely threw me. And I asked a very, very stupid first base cliche question to kick things off, and spent the rest of the interview struggling to recover, quite frankly. Mads was great. Me, not so much. So enjoy this interview. Well, I say enjoy. We're delighted to be joined on the Empire Podcast by Mads Mikkelsen. How are you, sir?
I'm very well.
Excellent. It wasn't too late at night last night at Westminster Abbey?
Late, but not too late.
Okay. How was that experience for you?
It was fantastic. I mean, standing in such an iconic place, it was surreal. Mm. A little blasphemic, actually. Sometimes we were taking photos and standing on people's graves.
Yeah, that's always a strange part.
Yeah, it is a little weird.
A place like that, but it must be one of the most surreal moments of your career, I guess, going to Westminster Abbey and...
Absolutely.
Yeah, being involved with a movie like this. Of course, you've got this. You've got Doctor Strange and Star Wars Rogue One coming up as well. Does that mean you've been given the freedom of Disney? You can go to all the Disney parks. You can do whatever you want in Disney.
You have a point. I should ask for that.
Yeah.
You're absolutely right.
You should never have to pay for a theme park again.
That's a good idea.
Just get it sorted out. What attracted you to this movie? Because I imagine post-Hannibal... You've been offered lots of quote unquote bad guy roles.
Mm-hmm. Well, a few. It's not been like uniquely going that way. I've also been offered other things. But this is obviously, it's Marvel. I grew up with Marvel comic books, and later on I've seen all the films.
Yeah.
So I am a huge fan of what they're doing with the books and putting them up on the big screen. Mm-hmm. Secondly, Benedict was playing Doctor Strange, which I thought was an absolutely fantastic choice. I can simply not imagine anyone else doing it. And then thirdly, a lot of flying kung fu. I've been waiting 50 years for that.
Is that something you practiced at home as a kid?
Constantly. I was Bruce Lee. Uh-huh. I mean, I was a small, skinny version of Bruce Lee when I was a kid.
Without the flying, obviously.
Well, I tried. Yeah. I gave it a shot. Yeah.
So, as a comic book fan, did you read comics then growing up? Is that something that...
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was very dedicated. I was... Obviously, the Marvel Universe was familiar to me, but I also read a lot of other things, a lot of European graphic novels. Mm-hmm. Will Eisner. I love Will Eisner and The Spirit. Yeah. So, yes, it was a huge part of my upbringing.
Well, that's interesting because I think a lot of people who come to comic book movies don't necessarily know the source material.
No.
So Doctor Strange was something you were actually familiar with.
I was familiar with it. I mean, As you can see in the film, and if you are familiar with the comic books, you will also know that when you're 7 years old, you won't grasp the fully philosophy of the novels. But you can enjoy the colors, the character, and the magic. And so that's the part I remember vivid.
Okay. So Marvel come to you and ask you to play Caecilius. It's a very interesting character. There's a sense that runs throughout the movie that he is a man to whom something terrible has happened in the past, something truly, truly awful.
Yes, obviously we have a background story. It's not super important for the actual story, but it's always nice for an actor to know that. But and throughout that journey of losing everything he had, he becomes his master sorcerer. But eventually he also becomes extremely disillusioned with especially the Ancient One, who is the mentor. She's like a wonderful demagogue, a dictator, who promises everybody that we will share. We all get $1,000, except me, I get $1 billion. And that fact, he just can't live with it. I mean, that's not democracy, that is just unjust. Yeah. He wants to have a slice of that cake.
Yeah, it's a very complex attitude towards the Ancient One. Without giving too much away, it's interesting that the first word we hear you speak in the movie is hypocrite. Towards the Ancient One. So that's a very interesting relationship to explore.
And he's right. She's a hypocrite. I mean, they're both thriving on a certain source to get their powers.
Yeah.
And obviously she thinks she's doing it in the right way. But who is she to judge?
That's the interesting thing about the Marvel movies. It has the colour. It has the whiz-bang action. It has the humour. But there's also a layer of depth to these movies that you wouldn't normally get in blockbusters. I think that's probably fair to say.
I think so. I think, I mean, as I said before, there's a philosophic part of the whole thing, which is all obviously very, very clear in the comic books as well. But the whole discussion about eternal life, it's very interesting. It's something that the human race has been discussing since they could talk, you know, inventing God, inventing Satan, inventing reasons to be here, and simply always asking the question, why am I here, and why does it stop?
Yes. Absolutely. There's a really interesting line that you have in the movie. Time is an insult.
Absolutely.
Death is an insult. But the time is an insult thing really, really, really
stuck. And it is. I mean, if you look at it from his perspective, and basically from everybody's perspective, it is an insult. It's simply we can't get our heads around it. Why? And when we can't get an answer for that question, we look towards religion to get an answer, right?
Yeah. We're all subject to the aging process. Do you find as you get older that... Do you agree with that? The time is an insult? You seem to, you're aging very well, sir.
Thank you so much. Well, I'm not as furious as my character, Caecilius. I've come to terms with the fact that even in my optimistic math book, there's only half of the life left, you know, if I'm lucky. That's annoying because I really think it's a funny life and I would like to have at least one more ride at the carousel. but it's not really in my hands. Right?
Is this career-wise, at least, the best part of your career? So far?
This moment right now? I don't know. I mean, it for me, time is just floating in different directions. I try not to stop up and say, this is it. It's going different directions nonstop, and there's nothing I really can do to control it, but I'm really pleased at this moment. But where it's going from here, I have no idea.
Because there are always interesting points in an actor's career. There are always choices you can make as an actor. And I think most recently, in the last 10 years, you make a Casino Royale and you play Le Chiffre and suddenly you're on the global stage.
Right.
And you have, at that moment, as an actor, you have choices to make. And I imagine, again, properties are being offered to you and, again, quote-unquote bad guy roles are being offered to you. You didn't necessarily go down that road.
No, I didn't. I mean, you're right that to a degree from America, it's the bad guy roles. And if the alternative is not to do anything in America, I'll take it any time.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, but back home and in Europe in general, I've done numerous different things.
Precisely.
I played a father, I played a doctor, I played an accused man of injustice. I'm not starving in the sense of like the hero parts. I mean, they exist in my life. And I try not to divide them up into good and bad guys. I read the script, I talk to the director, and if I can feel that he has a vision with this with his work, then I'm jumping on board.
Is Denmark still home for you?
Absolutely, I still have a base in Copenhagen.
Okay,
but you flip back and forth? Because the America thing is always interesting. It's a deliberate choice to go there and to do blockbusters. And as you say, you're doing incredible work in Europe as well.
Yeah, and back and forth. I mean, I've actually never, ever worked in America. All the American productions I've done has been shot in Europe.
Yeah,
so there's never been a reason for me to move and bring my family to L.A. and I'll go back and work in Romania. That doesn't make sense.
I have to ask about Hannibal as well, because obviously it came to an end. Many people, I included, feel prematurely. Mm. Is it still? I mean, there was talk that it might flourish once more. You might be able to do a movie or something. As far as you're concerned, is that gone now?
Well, everything at this point is gone, and most importantly, right now, Brian Fuller is gone in the sense that he's working on Star Trek. Right, he's the soul and life and heart behind the whole thing, and without him, there is no Hannibal. So, but if he decides to pick it up again, and he can find a channel that will eventually help us out, I think everybody would jump on board.
Absolutely. Were you happy with how it ended?
But you know, Hannibal can end every season that they make a finish that works, right? Because yes, we never know if it's going to be renewed. Yes, I think it's a wonderful open ending. It's a very Sherlock Holmes Moriarty moment.
It really is. I mean, it was such a wonderful, complex show. Obviously, Brian Fuller is a brilliant, brilliant person. Did you know going into it how complex it would be and how dark it would be?
Yeah, I had a fairly good hunch. Brian was pitching. He had 10 minutes to pitch the two seasons. And after 3 hours, he was still going on. And he was in season 14 or something. And I was just watching this man. It was like everything came out of him. He had so many ideas. And it was so dark and so radical. And I just loved everything that he came up with.
And on a similar scale, I guess, you have also someone like Kevin Feige at Marvel. Is Kevin how Doctor Strange came about for you? Did you hear from him first, or how did this happen?
I heard from Scott. Okay. Scott gave me a phone call, and he was pitching the whole story there. So I know that Kevin is also the mastermind behind a lot of things, but he also let Scott be the translator of that, be the director. So our touch with the Marvel Universe was through Scott. And I think that's the way it should be. I need one director and one guru when it comes to one film. But I'm sure that Kevin and Scott has had numerous long talks together late at night.
How did Scott pitch this to you?
Well, as I said, the magic words was flying kung fu eventually. But he was just talking about the story about the Doctor Strange in general. And the story is mesmerizing. And Benedict fills out those shoes completely. The action part was definitely something I cherished.
Oh, really? How was that for you? Because was it a lot of green screen?
A lot of green screen, yeah. Definitely. But also a lot of sets that was actually built. I mean, you get surprised how much they actually have there physically. But yes, when we do flip around with buildings, that's green screen. And it didn't have an enormous impact on us in the sense that we always have each other for a dialogue or for a fight scene. There's somebody to interact with. Uh-huh. Once in a while, we are in the midst of the whole thing. Uh-huh. And then we have to go and watch this little animated version of the scene they already done. So uh-huh. We can get a fairly good idea what's up and what's down and where is Trafalgar Square now.
Which is, of course, accurate because the opening of the movie takes place just around the corner.
Just around the corner, yeah. I saw that the other day.
Yeah. Were you filming here? Or was
we were shooting on there. I think I sealed it off on a Sunday, and it was very cold. But and no green screen, of course.
No green screen. No,
But super cool to stand in the midst of London and make it fall apart
and run around in that cracking costume of yours. I spoke to Benedict and I asked him, was there a moment when he felt that he was Doctor Strange? And he said it was, you know, filming in Times Square, running around, and those famous shots of him and Chiwetel leaping up and down in the air. And you were around for those scenes as well in Times Square. Mm-hmm. But was there a moment when you felt, okay, this is it, I am Caecilius?
Pretty early in the process, I think, because they, you know, putting on bits and pieces of the costume. But eventually when they had the whole costume there and when we had the mad and crazy makeup on, you realize that I'm not in a kitchen sink drama film here. I am in a Marvel film. And it felt good because I don't think we could justify running around in Adidas and doing what we're doing.
No, this is true. This is very true. Was it cumbersome, those ropes?
They were cool. I mean, they were slightly heavy to begin with, but the more we trained and worked out, the stronger we got. But in the very beginning, I couldn't imagine that I would be able to fly around in it because, 20 pounds or something, right? But we got there.
And how was the flying kung fu for you?
Amazing.
After all those years.
Yeah, after all those years. Amazing. Yeah. And I realized that they couldn't fly in those days. They actually used wires.
Yeah, that's true.
So did we. and the wire work is really, really fun because that's a dance with the stunt guys. They have to understand how you move and be right at the spot where you jump and turn around and to give you a little aid. And that is a wonderful cooperation to have with the stunt guys.
I've spoken to many actors over the years who've done a lot of wire work, a lot of harness work, and they say it can be quite delicate on your person.
Yes.
Yeah, on the unmentionables.
Absolutely.
How was it for you?
The trick is, I mean, if you tighten it too much, you can't really move. Yeah. And if you tighten it too little, you will get in trouble, right? So trick is to, you know, scoot over to one side and cross your fingers and hope for the best.
Hope for the best. And you have, you say the makeup, the Caecilius has this interesting appearance.
Him and his followers, the zealots. The closer they get to their mentor, their guru, the more physical it will show. And the more dedicated they are, the more physical it will show in their faces. And I think it's a cool little trick or gimmick, whatever you want to call it. But it looks really awesome, especially up close. It's almost like a whole world full of cracks.
And that was actual makeup, was it?
That was real makeup. Okay. It was about 2 hours every day.
I have to ask about one of your co-stars who listens to this Empire podcast, Scott Adkins.
Yeah.
How was it working with Scott?
Great. I mean, he is a master of the flying kung fu already.
He can actually fly, I believe.
Yeah. Pretty much so. Well, I spent a lot of time with him and the other zealots. So we had a great time. And it's always fun to be around people who know stunts the way he does because it's unavoidable that there will be a competition going on really fast. and I just embrace that. I think it's so funny.
Okay, so even if it's someone who's trained in physicality.
I'll take him on.
As an actor, you take him on.
Absolutely, awesome. Yeah.
Did you have sling ring competitions? Because I was fascinated by the way you guys... Did you have to go to like Doctor Strange... boot camp?
Or? Yeah, we did a boot camp, but not so much a sling ring competition boot camp. But we had one of the guys on my team was Julian. He was the master of all these gestures, and he was teaching us how to do it. And the issue was that his hands were so flexible and fingers crazy flexible, so it was not exactly the way it looked when we did it. So we had to adapt a little to our needs. But he was really good at teaching us then.
Fantastic. So now Doctor Strange is about to come out. It's come out now in the country. Today it opens. And Star Wars is next. Mm-hmm. Which in its own way is just as crazy, obviously. Are you ready for the publicity round for that and the craziness that comes with that movie?
I'm fairly ready. I'm in shape after this, I guess.
Yeah.
But we'll get a little break and then we'll start over again. And I'm looking forward.
And what was it about? I mean, obviously we won't talk about that film in detail, but... what was it about that movie, about Star Wars? Was it the same as with Doctor Strange?
Yeah,
Marvel,
pretty much so.
Star Wars.
Yes, it is. It's iconic stuff. I mean, I don't think... is there any film franchise that's gone on for that long? Maybe the Bond one? But it's iconic in itself, right? And it also revolutionized the whole way of using CGI and what you were able to put on the big screen. So, and again, we grew up with it. So it's just a big honor to be part of that family.
And the minute you have that costume on and you're in that world,
again,
it just feels surreal.
It is surreal. It's even more surreal when you're walking on the set and there's a table with 50 stormtrooper helmets lying there. This is when you realize what we're doing.
Yeah. We're in Star Wars. What's next for you after that?
A break. A nap.
How long? 6 months nap?
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
Like the old bears.
Mads, it's been an absolute pleasure. Likewise. Are you going to run around the hotel for old time's sake?
No, I'm going to take a sneak nap as well.
It is a hotel, you might as well.
It is.
Fantastic. Mads, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Mads Mikkelsen there, talking about what attracted him to the project, a question that I actually asked.
We've all done it. It happens.
15 years I've been doing this job, Helen.
That's usually my best question. What?
No, I'm
okay.
Not.
Yeah.
I can't believe I asked that question. You can listen during the interview. You can actually hear me dying of shame. It's like that Simpsons moment. You stop the tape.
Oh, I thought that was the sound of his hair being perfect.
Okay, so let's move on from my shame and embarrassment to movie news. And as per usual, big news broke last week after the podcast went up. Almost immediately after the podcast went up, in fact. Weird that Donald Glover
has been cast, officially cast, has been rumoured for a while, as Lando Calrissian in Phil Lord and Christopher Miller's Han Solo movie.
This makes me furious. Here's why. I don't want to care about a young Han Solo movie. It's a bad idea. And yet, then they go and hire Phil Lord and Chris Miller, who I think are geniuses.
Yep.
And then they hire Alden Ehrenreich, who I think is really, really good. And then they hire Donald Glover, who I'm really excited by as Lando Calrissian. And now I have to look forward to it. And I... it's just infuriating. So, you know, yeah, brilliant. Thanks, guys.
Yeah, I'm furious as well. Absolutely furious. This is very, very good casting.
It
I
is.
Think.
Yeah, you can't really argue with it, can you?
Yeah, I'm with Helen. Yeah. It doesn't sound like a great idea, but.
But damn it, it doesn't also sound like a great idea.
But a lot of charisma in those, you know, four people.
Yeah.
Yep. I'm still. Everything depends on who the cast is. Chewbacca. That's a big one for me.
Yeah,
but you know, but maybe it'll be that guy—the guy who does them in the new movies.
Yes, presumably will. Yeah. Are you available though, Chris? If they call you for Chewbacca,
I am available.
Uh huh.
I would have to either ride a unicycle or
yeah.
which I think would be a great way to go, or they'd have to put me in a box.
Right. Okay.
Because I'm about. A foot and a half smaller than Chewbacca.
Okay. Well, I mean, we can workshop it. I feel like, you know, they can make something happen.
Yeah.
I mean, hey, Hugh Jackman is taller than Wolverine, and that worked out. You could just be a slightly shorter Chewbacca.
Yeah.
It could work, Chris.
Chewbacca, what happened? Well, because he's younger, right?
Yeah.
He's younger, so maybe he hasn't had a growth spurt yet.
Exactly.
And he's got some puppy fat. So I think that could work.
I mean, we'd have to work around the prequels, but we'll workshop it. It'll be fine.
I've got my voice down.
There's
as well.
Nothing that says Wookiees have to age in a you know in a steady manner. Is
hey, Han, how's it going?
It's amazing, Phil Lord and Chris Miller. If you're listening, Chris will take your call.
Why would you be on a unicycycle?
Why wouldn't you be on a
unicycle? Millennium Falcon's about to go into hyperspace.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm juggling.
Where's
Jason?
Chewie? Have you seen Chewie? Yeah, he's in the back on the unicycle again.
Yeah.
Why not?
It's a younger Chewbacca. He is
The circus days.
Absolutely. Who's to say that Han Solo didn't rescue Chewbacca from a circus?
Wow.
We
may have gotten slightly off topic here.
Anyway, so put your trust in the Lord and the Miller.
Hey.
I say. I was lucky enough to be at their lecture this week. They did BAFTA have done a series of screenwriting lectures recently. The likes of Kenneth Lonergan and Park Chan-wook came in, and Maren Ade came in, and they did what I presume, because I wasn't around to see them sadly, are very serious, very straightforward lectures about how screenwriting is a really, really serious art. And then Lord Miller came in, and they just, you know, they effed the whole B up, man, and they just explicit language, and they were really funny but also really insightful and kind of terrifying in terms of their work ethic, so I think a transcript of that is somewhere on the BAFTA website, or it may be even filmed, you may be able to see it, so I would check that one out. But yeah, the more I hear about this Han Solo movie, the more I'm hopeful.
Yeah, me too. Damn it. Hey, staying in space, there was slightly less good news this week for Star Trek Discovery, which is the return of Star Trek to its original home on TV. It had already been moved back from January of next year, 2017, to May, and that was sort of put down to things still being finessed, as well as the fact that Brian Fuller, who's showrunning, is also working on American Gods. But Fuller is now stepping down from the project, presumably because of those clashes, presumably because of just the sheer workload of launching two shows. And he'll be replaced by Gretchen J. Berg and Aaron Harbert, I'm not sure how to pronounce it, I apologise, who both worked with him previously on Pushing Daisies and Wonderfuls. So we actually still don't have, as far as I know, a start date for Star Trek Discovery. So it definitely isn't going to be January. And it's looking a little bit touch and go for May, I would have thought. The cast are not apparently signed, although sets are being constructed. The loss of Fuller is one that's going to be sort of upsetting for fans and so on. Yeah. Apparently, Fuller has already helped sort of, and I quote, chart the course of the series. So, you know, you've got to hope that that's already kind of set things in motion to... Mm. to deliver something a little bit different and a little bit exciting for Star Trek. But I'm really excited to see Star Trek back on TV, I think. I mean, much as I like the films, mostly, I do think that there's a lot to be said for the TV show format for this particular property, just because it's so much, or it should be so much about ideas, and it gives you a little bit more room to play with those and a little bit more room to develop characters.
What could be more prestigious and more important than Star Trek?
Well, American Gods is also a pretty big deal, so, you know, he's not exactly hurting for work.
I do wonder, though, if this means, obviously I spoke to Mads Mikkelsen when I wasn't making an absolute idiot of myself. We did talk a little bit about Hannibal, very little bit about Hannibal, whether there might be still hope that it might come back. And you never know, the fact that he's no longer doing Star Trek Discovery.
Maybe.
Which Mikkelsen did not know about. And none of us knew it, obviously, at that time. Maybe that means that there might be some life in the old Doctor yet.
Maybe. I think that's probably a leap, alas. Yeah. But, I mean, American Gods, as we know, he's seeing that it's not a one-series adaptation of the book. It's definitely a continuing developing project that will be coursed over that will be told over the course of several seasons. So, you know, it's not that he's shot that and is out. It's very much still a going concern. So it may just be the workload was a little bit too much even for him. But still, bad news for Star Trek, and let's hope that it's still an awesome show.
Yes. Good news Yay. For fans of Shaun the Sheep.
Who isn't?
Which is everybody. Shaun the Sheep 2 has been announced, and it's going to be live action.
Wait, what?
With real sheep.
What?
Right. No, I misread that. It's going to be, again, Odd Man.
Oh, thank God.
Stop motion animation. And they're promising even greater heights of lunacy for the sequel.
Amazing.
Which would be impressive, because the first one was pretty mental.
It is, yeah.
But that can only be good news, because who doesn't like Shaun the Sheep? I mean,
well, this is it. I think people who don't have tiny children may not have watched the Shaun the Sheep movie and the Shaun the Sheep TV show spin-offs of course, Wallace and Gromit. They are really delightful, though. Like, just the physical comedy. I mean, you know, basically none of the characters speak, but the physical comedy on that show is just wonderful. And the sort of the character detail they get in those little models. Oh,
unbelievably
great.
Funny. Silent and if you love silent movies.
Yeah. Which you do.
Which I love silent movies. Well, so do you.
I do.
Don't we all? I mean, there's so much wit in the physical comedy.
Yeah, there is.
And so many ideas. So looking forward to that
one. So after Paddington 2 last week and you know, Shaun the Sheep 2 this week, it's a good year to be a kid who likes British movies, I guess.
Kid of any age. And yeah. Speaking of 2s, Deadpool 2.
Yeah, now some slightly worrying news there this week.
Yeah. Tim Miller has departed the project. Tim Miller, of course, the director of Deadpool, announced originally on this very podcast, and obviously a colossal success. So the sequel is no surprise. But what, by all accounts, has happened is that Tim Miller had grander ideas for the sequel. If you saw the first one, which most people seem to have done, the VFX was a little shonky. It was a little rough around the edges. Ryan Reynolds, the star, has been arguing that was part of the charm of the thing, and I'd be inclined to agree with him. Tim Miller was pushing for a much bigger budget, much more of the bells and whistles VFX work and big studio type projectness, and Ryan Reynolds was not in favour, and obviously the studio probably weren't either, because given the choice between making a cheap film and a really expensive one, they're probably usually going to take the former option. So Tim Miller has departed the project, which leaves it currently directorless. I would imagine that won't remain the case for long. You'd think they could have their pick of quite a few directors for that one.
Well, what's been interesting about this week is that there is a petition. Have you seen this? A petition online to get Quentin Tarantino to direct the movie. And I have to say, I think this is a Black Mirror episode in the making, which is, can you imagine the misery of a film director forced to direct a film he has no interest in directing because a petition had enough signatures to make it legally binding that he had to do it? And he's just sitting there going, action. And,
I don't think that's how petitions work, though, Chris.
I know, but, you know.
Oh, okay. Yes, in Black Mirror.
In this Black Mirror episode, it would be. I just find that absolutely ridiculous. I mean, Quentin Tarantino, a man who once famously, for me anyway, because I really remember this quote, likened CGI
He hates CGI. And he said, if I want something like that, I'll stick my dick in a Nintendo.
which is similar.
Which doesn't make a lot of sense, but it's a great quote. He's never going to make a comic book movie of that type. And then someone else, I think Mark Miller the other day, said on Twitter that Edgar Wright would be perfect for it. Edgar Wright is not going to make a comic book movie, I think, after...
Edgar Wright, did you see, he posted a picture on Instagram of him walking his dog on a beach, and it was just, it was a beautiful picture of shadows on a beach, essentially, and the first comment was, please direct Deadpool.
Yeah, and obviously people will now go, he's already directed a comic book movie. Yes, he has, but I mean, after Ant-Man, I don't think he's going to go there again, do you think?
Major studio comic book movie, yeah.
Yeah.
There was a call for Deadpool to direct the Deadpool movie.
Yes.
Now that, I think, is an exciting prospect.
I believe that was my call.
Oh, was it?
It was. Yeah, no, I think the best way to go with this is something I tweeted the other day, which is Deadpool should direct this. He should direct it himself. Now, I know that seems unlikely, but go with me. If they can find a director, a patsy, who's willing to just not take a credit and then just pretend to be Deadpool directing this film, because this film, I think, needs to go up, all out gonzo craziness. And what better way to do that than have Deadpool direct his own movie? Mm. I think that's the way to go. Phil, you've got something, haven't you?
I've got so much stuff.
I've got so much stuff
it's
to talk
ridiculous.
About.
Well, just quickly, if you love Mike Banning...
And who doesn't?
Who doesn't love Mike Banning?
Well, terrorists, that's
terrorists.
Who.
Anyone from the Republic of Fuckheadistan doesn't like Mike Banning, but yeah, everyone else
that's
loves
a direct
him.
Quote, we must say. From
yeah,
London
I think that isn't just me being that's, racist. Yeah. That is a quote from London Has Fallen, a movie that made a... eye-watering and barely believable nearly £200 million at the box office, dollars at
and
the
most
box
of that's
office.
Jerry Butler going to see it
pounds,
over and
dollars,
over again
whatever. Yes,
four for London Has Fallen.
400,000. I know people love these movies. I for the life of me don't know why. They seem like Olympus Has Fallen was not good. London Has Fallen was significantly worse.
Olympus Has Fallen was I thought it was fine.
It was no White House Down, was it?
I actually preferred it to White House Down.
I
preferred the White House Down.
White House Down is infinitely superior to Olympus Has Fallen.
It's a better made movie. But,
yeah. No, but it's a lot more fun.
White House Down is.
Yeah.
But Olympus Has Fallen had the line, let's play a game of fuck off, you go first.
That
and
was a
for
great
that
line.
Reason alone.
No, it's not enough.
That is literally the only reason.
That's
you
the
like
only
this movie.
Reason.
And it was a good one. I remember watching it with you and we both chuckled.
Yeah.
So anyway, this one's called Angel Has Fallen.
So, but it's basically Air Force One goes down, which we've seen before. In Big Game, and we've seen it obviously in Air Force One.
Yes.
I think among others, I'm pretty sure there's another couple along the same lines. So for me, they're going to struggle a little bit. And I personally would have maybe preferred it if it was literally just, you know, Angel Tube Station. I mean, you could have done it on a smaller budget. Yes, it's retreading some of the same ground as London Has Fallen, but you've got a chance to get the geography of London right this time.
Okay, Angel Has Fallen. Right.
It says here, an angel has fallen. Once again, scripted, and it doesn't even have air quotes around scripted, which is very, very nice, by Creighton Rothenberger and Katrine Benedict, who were my two favourite contestants on The Great Bulgarian Existential Bake Off. Banning himself becomes the target of a terrorist attack. And this makes sense, because if you were a terrorist, right, you would want to take out, what's the deadliest threat, the number one threat to terrorists in the world today?
Is Mike Banning.
Is Mike Banning. So... You would target him, wouldn't you?
Absolutely.
You would go after him.
He's the only thing standing between these evil terrorists and total global domination.
Yeah. The only reason this podcast is coming line. To people now is because Mike Banning is out there patrolling the streets of London.
We need him on that wall.
We do.
Angel.
I'd vote for Mike Banning. You know, it may be... He may not be able to run for president because he clearly isn't from America, but... I think I would vote for him. He'd be great. So anyway, Angel Has Fallen. Its production is expected to begin in the first half of 2017, and if the production values of the previous movies are anything to go by, it should be finished by the first half of 2017. So we hope we can watch it by next summer. I'm excited about this. It's going to be the best. It's going to be, let's be honest, the best worst movie of 2018. And if you're not excited about that, then
I pity you.
Yeah. It's,
you've got no joy in your heart.
Yeah.
If you're not excited by the prospect of Gerard Butler punching random foreign people in the face.
I hope he punches a plane.
Stabbing.
I hope it's some domestic terrorists this time just to mix it up.
Yeah.
There you go, I say.
Yeah.
Boom, politics.
Yeah, well, of course we had Dylan McDermott, didn't we?
Well, we did. Yeah. We've had a couple of, yeah. But, you know, but not just co-conspirators, but actual full-on.
Actual full-on terrorists, yeah.
Badens.
Yeah.
Hey, there's Pixar news. Which we should probably talk about. Pixar release date news, the very best sort of Pixar news.
It's my favourite release date news.
It's amazing. So they've essentially swapped two release dates. So The Incredibles 2 will be arriving in June 2018, at least in America. It's usually about a month later for us here because apparently Pixar hates us and wants us to suffer.
It's the reverse Marvel.
Yeah. And Toy Story 4 will then shift back into The Incredibles 2's original date in 2019. So that's June 2019, again, probably July here. So at the moment, the schedule runs as follows. Next year, 2017, we're going to have Cars 3 and the Day of the Dead themed Coco from Lee Anchorage. Then The Incredibles 2 in 2018 and Toy Story 4 in 2019. I don't know if there's going to be maybe a second hit in 2018 or 2019, another original movie, but at the moment that's our lineup. Mm-hmm. So it's really good news that we'll see Incredibles a little bit sooner, and it obviously suggests that film is well on, that the story's in good shape, that they're kind of moving it up that way. But yeah, that is the current state of play. Shea Pixar.
Boom. Just quickly,
yeah,
because we have another thing to talk about.
Yeah.
There's been the announcement of a untitled Alexander McQueen project. Mm. Now, Alexander McQueen, as everyone probably knows, was a fashion designer, sort of enfant terrible of British fashion.
Absolutely.
Chief designer at Givenchy. And he's going to be played by Jack O'Connell, which straight away to me seems really good casting.
Yeah, now for those out there who are thinking Jack O'Connell looks nothing like a fashion designer, you need to look up a picture of Alexander McQueen because it's actually spot on casting for him.
They look, yeah, there is an immediate physical resemblance, which always helps with a kind of semi biopic, but you don't need it.
No,
Michael Fassbender is Steve Jobs.
Yeah.
Oh, Steve Jobs. I haven't talked about that for a while. But the fiery, intense, troubled, tortured man that was Alexander McQueen, I think, plays into Jack O'Connell's kind of acting wheelhouse.
Yes, definitely.
Not to make him sound too much like a ship. There are elements of the Alexander McQueen story that do sound a little bit like offcuts from Zoolander. his Highland Rape collection was notorious.
It was. It's actually, I mean, there's some beautiful clothes in
Don't
that
get
collection.
Me wrong.
I went to the exhibition at the V&A a couple of years ago. The clothes are gorgeous. The name of the collection, maybe not so great, but carry
yeah,
on.
Yeah, it's very Nathan Barley sounding, isn't it?
Yes.
But yeah, he died tragically in 2010, but it's going to be, this film is going to be set in the lead up, sort of Steve Jobs style. Mm. This will be second reference in the podcast.
This is amazing.
In 2009. So it's going to
make it up for last time, Phil.
Yeah, I know, it's incredible. So it's going to be in the lead up to this famous show that he did in 2009,
okay.
Showing his creative process. So it's not going to be the full story, but it should be plenty of dramatic.
Peter Mullen once told me that he bought an Alexander McQueen jumper from TK Maxx that he was reading through the clothes, and he found one that was worth £300 down to 30, and I hope they have that in the movie.
Wow. Well, if you told me that Peter Mullen invested in a pair of Alexander McQueen bumsters, I would have. It would have.
That would certainly be a look.
You need to explain what bumsters are to
Chris.
No.
I went completely blank there. What the hell?
Bumsters.
What's bumsters?
Am I right, Helen? I'm looking at you here. Is this, he invented a sort of a low cut jean?
Yes.
Like half crack.
So. Yes.
Half jean.
Are they the ones you wear? Because your builder's crack is on display in the office. Mm-hmm. More than I care to remember.
I don't know what's happening there.
It's really quite something.
Yeah. I'm gonna work on that. I found myself a pair of dungarees or something.
Phil sits
there?
Directly behind me in the office. And sometimes I turn around and it's like, have you come to fix the pipes?
It's
a little bit like that.
It's my autumn derelict collection. I come to fix the pipes.
It's a very nice bottom, Phil. I just don't necessarily want to see it.
There's a new issue this week.
There is a new issue. Yay! A new issue of Empire Time. Yes, yes indeedy. It's on sale now in all good and evil newsagents. But there's a twist.
There is. Oh. If you go to certain Sainsbury's stores, and there is a map online on our Twitter feed, and I believe on the website, you have the chance to get an amazing video cover, because this is the cover for Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, which is obviously out in November. And we have got, with a huge amount of help from Warner Brothers and J.K. Rowling herself, we have an incredible video cover designed in the fashion of a Wizarding World newspaper, and with sort of contemporary stories to the story of Fantastic Beasts there on the cover, and then video that plays inside it to give you that real Wizarding World feel. It's really cool. It's super cool. And judging by the way that the limited edition Kylo Ren magazines sold out, you're going to have to get in there quick if you want a chance to get one. So
I've got loads of those at home.
Chris, no.
Stockpiled them.
No,
I've got,
that wasn't...
Like, I've got dozens.
We aren't allowed
one, dozens.
Never mind dozens,
No, I've got,
Chris.
I've got loads. They're filed under rainy day. That's the pension. Am I not meant
Chris,
to say this?
Oh, really? No,
I've
Chris.
I've maybe got hundreds.
Put them back. We're going to need you to put them back. I'm going to tell Terry.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Well, we can cut this bit out.
Those weren't for you. Anyway, we also have, if you can't get that, don't despair, because the magazine itself is a great, great issue. Nick has done, I'm very jealous because I wanted to go on set, but Nick went on set and he has done a fantastic job. He spoke to everyone. He got all the secrets that could be gotten from them about Fantastic Beasts. We've got some gorgeous art that shows you the beasts for the first time, including the Thunderbird on the cover. And if you're a subscriber, you're going to get that gorgeous Thunderbird cover particularly, which I'm quite jealous of because I don't get one. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. Inside the issue, we have a huge amount more.
Yes, we do. We have other great things. So many great things.
You don't know, do you, Chris?
I'm so glad you asked. No.
Okay.
I don't have an issue to hand.
Aaron Eckhart was the big interview this month. He's obviously got two big films coming out,
right.
Bleed for this and Sully. He's getting a lot of Oscar buzz, especially for the first one. So there's a really interesting photo shoot with him inside.
Is it true that the phone call for Angel Has Fallen arrived halfway through the interview and he immediately lobbed his phone out the window?
No, that is not the case, filibuster, as you know.
He wouldn't throw his phone out the window. He'd be excited and jazzed to reprise the role of President Benjamin Asher.
I can't believe you remember his name.
Neither can I.
Aaron, please report to set. We need to handcuff you to a railing for the duration. I interviewed Amor Asante about the United Kingdom, the film that opened this year's London Film Festival. It was she talked through the process of making this movie in the 50 degree heat of Botswana. So if you want to get behind the scenes on a fairly classical kind of romantic historical drama, that's the place to do it.
Mm-hmm. We also have, into time with Fantastic Beasts, we have the 30 best Harry Potter characters, which we all voted, or you all voted for, and we divided up the writing between ourselves. As well as that, we look back at the original Batman, or at least the original Adam West Batman, 50 years later, which is a really fun piece. We go inside the mind of Nicolas Cage and find some interesting stuff inside.
Did we get out again?
Well, that would
just
be
about
a spoiler.
Just
we look back at Donnie Darko. We've taken a look at Netflix's The Crown. Mm-hmm. And as well as all the stuff, review. Chris, that's your section. Do you want to talk about
Neon
Demon?
Yeah, I can never
Demon.
Remember what's in the magazine. It's good stuff.
Tess is
it's
in
good
there.
Stuff. Yeah. So we got a story. This isn't... Just get the whole magazine. It's great. But we got Adam West talking about the 1960s Batman. We got Ken Loach on Kez, which is fantastic. We got Nicholas Winding Refn taking us through the Neon Demon. One thing I really, really like in Empire recently, we've launched a new thing called the First Take Club, which is a complete and shameless ripoff of the brilliant Ram Album Club from Twitter, where people listen to albums that they've never heard before and they write about them. A guy called Martin Fitzgerald runs that. It's absolutely amazing. Some of the best writing you will find in music anywhere. So I ripped that off with, it has to be said, Martin's blessing.
Okay.
Got in touch with Martin, first of all. Can we do this? Yes, you can do this. Thank you very much, Martin. Nice guy. Thank you very much. And so we get interested people to write about films they haven't seen before. So this month, really happy with this, Ian Rankin, the creator of the Rebus novels, talks about Amelie. So, you know, there's loads of good stuff in there.
Also, in the preview section, you should be aware, we've got a look at Passengers. So if you're a fan of Chris Pratt and Jennifer Lawrence, like most of the planet, get after that. Mm-hmm. And M. Night Shyamalan talks about Split. Which just had the trailer launch online this week. We didn't talk about that, but well worth a look as well.
If I were interested in, for instance, a new look at Keanu Reeves' action movie, John Wick 2,
you would also find that,
But you should mention that, because then I'll just go off on one about John Wick for ages, and that's a dangerous thing to do.
John Wick, yay!
Yay! So lots of great stuff inside the issue, as Chris Evans once said, and it's available now in all good and evil newsagents, and of course on the iPad as well. Okay, time now for our second guest this week. He is one of our favourite American actors. He's been in the podcast before. He's a man who almost always makes strong and compelling choices, and even when the choices aren't that compelling, he's often the best thing in them. His latest is Tom Ford's second movie, Nocturnal Animals. He is, of course, Jake Gyllenhaal, and he was speaking to John Nugent. Enjoy.
Jake Gyllenhaal, welcome to the Empire Podcast. Welcome back to the Empire Podcast.
Yes, thank you for having me again.
How are you?
I'm well, yeah. I'm good, yeah.
We're here to talk about Nocturnal Animals. You play sort of dual roles in this film. You play sort of a Texan author, but also a character in one of his books.
Mm-hmm.
I'm interested to know, like, what's that like as an actor? Sort of, is that technically challenging to distinguish those performances?
No, not in this case. I mean, in this case, I think sort of an evolution of a character as put in different order. In a way, the main character that I play is, in a way, a figure of Amy Adams' character's imagination.
Mm.
So he's sort of a fictional character. And then the other character is the guy who wrote the book, you know, so
yeah,
that he's in. So really, he's a younger version, too, of the writer. So really, it's sort of an evolution of age. It's not sort of the same character in a lot of ways. So they are, one is fictional and one is supposedly non-fictional in a fictional story.
Right. Yeah. They're sort of subtly linked, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting because you've played dual roles before in Enemy. Did you approach that in a different way? Was that like a more technically challenging?
Yeah, it was, because in that movie, I was acting with myself. I think that was kind of the most interesting aspect of it for me, besides working with Denis Villeneuve. I think it was that I was able to explore what it was like to sort of play across from my own choices, play across from my own instinct. And that was fascinating. Using my imagination to sort of communicate with myself.
Yeah.
Is very different than a character that is a creation of you. In the case of Nocturnal Animals, you know?
Yeah. Do you get paid more for playing two roles in one film?
No.
No. No conversation.
I've gotten paid a lot less, I think, for playing two roles, actually.
You're not getting as much value for money.
Yeah, it's such an interesting topic of discussion. You could be a very good negotiator. I've never even thought of that.
This film sort of explores responsibility and culpability and masculinity in a way. I read in one review, the last person you want to meet if you're worried about your masculinity is Michael Shannon in a cowboy hat. What's it like playing opposite him in this sort of full sheriff mode?
You know, I play a character who doesn't really have a lot of, not your quintessential idea of masculinity that I play. I don't really act upon, you know, my instincts in a way. My instinct in this movie is taken from me as a character. So I was playing a character that didn't really have much, I don't know, I guess you could say drive. And Michael's character really does. Like, it's always a joy to play opposite Michael, you know? I mean, I have had the opportunity to do different readings with him and act with him, and I've known him for many years, so it's, you know, he's incredible. But, you know, as actors, I think, and the way that we approach what we do, we're very similar. I am not my character, and neither is he. So, but in terms of working with him, it's always a joy.
Interestingly, I noticed there's a sort of mini Donnie Darko reunion on this film, because Jenna Malone is in, although you don't share the screen.
Mm-hmm.
Have you had a chance to, like, did you have a chance to meet her on set or during the press tour at all?
No, I didn't. But Jenna's actually really incredible in this movie.
Yeah.
It's like sort of very striking,
her
scenes in this movie. And she's quite an extraordinary human. Has always been through the years. I mean, that was a long time ago when we worked together. But yeah, I didn't even know that she was in the movie.
Oh, wow.
Until I saw the film, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's got quite an amazing cast, really, isn't it? You've got these amazing actors in tiny roles, like Laura Linney,
As
Amy Adams' mother is just incredible.
Yeah.
You know, she's only on screen for like 3 minutes and,
you
know, steals the show almost.
Yeah.
Yeah, I did want to ask just a little bit about Donnie Darko, because it's been 15 years now. And in an upcoming issue of Empire, we're doing a retrospective.
Yes.
Do you ever get an inkling that films will be talked about, you know, 15 years hence?
I don't think you have any perspective on anything until it's 15 years later, you know, and you don't think you know what anything's going to be until that time has actually passed. I mean, we knew at the time that what we were making was special. I mean, I've been lucky enough to feel that way about almost every film I've made. You also know when things aren't working, and, you know, it's almost like covering your eyes to watch a crash at times, you know, but in the case of that one, I think it was saying something very special. I think the essence of it was, I think the group of people that were gathered to make it were very particular and really individual in their own right, all from many different facets of, you know, the industry, like all the actors, different styles, and just sort of a fascinating group of people. So I think we did feel like it was special when we were making it, but, you know, that people would be talking about it 15 years later, or that the, you know, that Empire would write a piece on it 15 years later about what it is, and that I would be asked in so many interviews about it, you know, over the many years that I've been doing interviews, is incredible. I never expected that.
Does it still come up then? Is it still a common question? Just
every single interview I've done today, yeah.
Every single one?
Yeah.
Wow. Well, I'm sorry to...
I haven't done that many, but still, every single one, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, sorry to be so predictable.
No, I think you're right in that it's like there's some anniversary of it, so people are sort of interested in it.
Yeah.
And I also think that in the UK, in particular, there was a real support. It was the first place that it was really recognized as something special.
Yeah.
It had been released in the US, and then no one had really paid that much of much attention, and then it came here, and I was doing a show on the West End, and I remember... I went to do press after I finished that show, and I was doing press for Donnie Darko, and I just felt this strange sort of groundswell here in a different way than when I had gone and done it in America.
Yeah.
And then it just took off from there.
Another one of those films, Nightcrawler. I just wanted to ask if you felt a sense of injustice at not being nominated for an Oscar. I know, obviously, it's not about the awards, but a lot of people felt that was the best performance of that year.
An injustice? I mean, I think awards generally, just as they are inherently, like, sort of strangely unjust process, you know? But real injustice is out there in the world in many more important, many more significant ways. I mean, I to think about the subject matter of that movie, in my opinion, it felt like it just hit too close to home, probably. You know, it probably just was saying a little bit too much about the business in general.
Yeah.
So maybe people just didn't necessarily, like, respond to that.
Yeah.
I'm always surprised at how people respond to me, like the last character I played or something. Like, if I have short hair and it's cut short hair, then people come up to me on the street and say, oh, I really liked you in Jarhead. Or, like, if my hair is longer, or I look a certain way, I have a beard, like, there's another movie reference. You know, it's like, I really think the process of all these things is, the result of these processes that I've been involved in is not, really not anything I can ever wrap my head around. Because all I have is the movie that I make and the process of that. And then, you know, so often people ask me about, like, you know, the result. And if you're not directing the film, the result is not in your control.
Yeah.
And the experience you shot on a movie is the only thing you have from it.
Yeah.
And the response people have to it's nice.
Yeah.
And if somebody, like, acknowledges you for that performance, that's nice and I'm grateful. But I'm just, like, all I want to do is keep working, you know?
Yeah.
So... that's my concern. You know?
Yeah, fair
I mean,
enough.
That really is my concern. I mean, I've been down the path of being interested or sort of, like, fascinated with that whole sort of sense of awards or things like that. And I think in the end, it's an honor if you are acknowledged, but it can also be like a very, very complicated thing. My brother-in-law said to me once, he said, what's confusing about being a movie actor in particular is that you give a performance and then a year later it comes out and then people respond to it and you're no longer the character anymore.
Yeah.
You're so far from the character you played or any relationship to it. And yet people are complimenting you on this thing that you've done and you can mistake it for yourself. Yeah. You can mistake the compliments that people give you for like something that is inherently you or something, and it's not something you did a year ago that is no longer you anymore, and people like it, not you.
Yeah.
And I think that's where people get very confused, and I think that's actually I think that's like, so if you talk about Nightcrawler, like I am so deeply, profoundly proud of that movie, and not just as an actor but like as a producer of that film and the filmmaking and what it was, and Dan Gilroy and his ability to have made this film like out of the gate and written this extraordinary script. And like, I think you'll talk to anybody who makes movies, really makes movies, and just making a movie that's good is fucking impossible.
Yeah.
So when you do that, you're like, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And everything else is sort of just ego.
Yeah, sure.
You know what I mean?
Sure.
I mean, it takes a lot of ego to make a good movie, but everything else after that really is that.
I mean, yeah. Roger Ebert, I think, said something like, every film is a miracle. You know, it's a miracle that you actually make it at all. So for it to be a good film is a miracle times 10, I guess.
I think that's why he had such a wonderful relationship with so many filmmakers, because I think he could acknowledge the piece of their hearts that they have to put into it.
So, I mean, you're an established actor now, obviously. You could be in any sort of blockbuster, but we see time and again you're in the more interesting movies or the more challenging movies or the smaller movies sometimes. I mean, can you explain what's your sort of methodology on how you select a script, on how you choose your next step?
I don't think there is any. I think, though, I don't just look at a script or a director. I do not believe that a movie is made only by a director or only because of a great script. I think that I choose a lot of the time based on four or five different aspects, which is primarily cinematographer and editor, and usually with a director that you really love and respect comes a great cinematographer and editor.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Because I think you can make a great movie out of a pretty good script, and you can make a bad movie out of a great script.
Yeah.
And you can make a great movie out of a great script too.
Yeah.
But it has to start fundamentally from a really interesting place. Sometimes there are pretty good scripts that have fundamentals that are really, really strong, and then a great group of people to bring them out. Yeah. And so I choose my movies based on that. Size or no size, it's based on that. It's based on a feeling of whether or not I can use my knowledge of the film industry, not just directors and movies they've made, but my personal obsession with cinematographers and my opinion that they really do make a movie. They really are the difference between something good and great, in my opinion. I would attribute Seamus McGarvey in this movie to a lot of that, not just in terms of the visuals. I think we tend to as an audience go, oh, it looks so beautiful. But storytelling, this is a visual medium. Yeah. Storytelling is told through that and what you see and what you don't see, which is eventually what the editor does. So that's how I choose, you know. I'm sort of like a full crew actor. Like I see the whole thing.
Yeah.
I don't just go like, oh, that person's shooting it. Nice. Oh, cool. Yeah. I go like, who's shooting it? and then I will make my decision, you know.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
It's a collaborative art, isn't it?
Yeah. I'm surprised in such a collaborative art how hard it is for so many of us to collaborate.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
Yeah. Well, I think that's all the time we have, Jake, but thank you so much for your time.
Please thank you.
Come back anytime.
All right, man. Thanks.
Cheers.
Okay, so that's Jakey G. Nocturnal Animals is out next week, I believe, isn't that right? I believe so. It's not out this week anyway, that's for sure, because you know what?
Yes.
There's one movie out this week. Well, actually, there's loads. But there's one movie out that most big studios are running from, and it's Doctor Strange. Marvel's Doctor Strange, the 14th movie in the MCU. We will have a spoiler special about this with four of us idiots talking about the movie in great detail, and also a very in-depth interview with director Scott Derrickson. That is, as we always do with the spoiler specials, it's being held back until the US release date. It's probably going to be up around November 7th.
Yeah.
So keep an eye out for the spoiler special coming up. In the meantime, let's talk about Doctor Strange. Is the good doctor the good doctor?
He's pretty good, actually, yeah. So this is an origin story, be warned. But we start off with Dr. Stephen Strange, a New York neurosurgeon, taking all the cases that are super challenging enough to have stumped everybody else, but not quite so challenging that they're completely impossible and will destroy his 100% record. Unfortunately, the quite arrogant, but certainly very gifted doctor gets into a car crash in his ridiculous sports car, and his hands are badly damaged to the extent where they shake and he can't continue in his profession. He goes through the options in Western medicine to try and fix them. Obviously, he's in that awkward position of knowing how bad the damage is, because that is literally his whole life. And when that fails, he follows a sort of a wild goose to Nepal, to Kathmandu, in search of the Temple of Kamar Taj, where another man tells him that he was healed of his nerve injury, his spinal cord injury in that case. So what Strange finds there, it will not entirely shock you to know if you know anything about the character, is the Ancient One, played here by Tilda Swinton. And she is the leader of a group of essentially magicians who protect the world against threats from other dimensions, with the help of
the Great Surprendo.
With the help of Master Mordo, one of chief sort of disciples, if you will, played by Chiwetel Ejiofor, and the librarian, played by Benedict Wong, whose name is also Wong, Strange begins to pick up this discipline, begins to learn these mystical arts, and discovers a world that is larger than he is, which is just as well, because Mads Mikkelsen is lurking. Yeah.
His sense of timing is excellent, it has to be said.
Master Caecilius has gone rogue.
He has.
With some acolytes of his own, and he is determined.
Including Scott Adkins.
Scott Adkins!
And he is determined to cause mischief. So that's the way things go. So anyway, yes, the story is something we've basically seen before in outline. Yes, there are similarities to be drawn, probably unfairly, but they are nevertheless there with the likes of Sherlock and characters that Benedict Cumberbatch has played before. But you have never seen anything like this. The fight scenes in this movie, the use of powers, the effects. I mean, it sounds really damning with faint praise at this point to say that a blockbuster on this scale has great effects, but this has jaw-droppingly great effects. This, you have genuinely never seen this before. I think when the trailers came out, everybody was a bit like, oh, it's just Inception.
Well, I have very strong feelings about
it. I know
that.
You do. But like Inception, you know, a city folded up a bit. In this...
yeah, precisely.
And it never really mattered. In this, the city basically dances. Like, crazy stuff happens. But it actually happens so beautifully that you can kind of tell what's going on. Yeah. This is not just a random festival of craziness. There's craziness with a purpose, and it is gorgeously done.
Also, are we so jaded as moviegoers that we look at astonishing, fully realised effect sequences and go, that looks a little bit like something that happened 9 years ago, seven years ago? Are we really that jaded? I mean, it's one element of Inception that movie does not follow up on in any way, shape or form. And it's just to the nth degree in this movie.
I genuinely believe Inception is the sketch and this is the sculpture. Yeah. Like, it just goes so much further.
Oh, there's more than just Foley and Sidney and Doctor Strange as well. Yes.
Well, to a point. I mean, one of the things I liked about Inception, which this film doesn't do, is it does ground it more in the practical, in the real world. You do feel like, I thought the best action sequence in this movie is the first one for me, when it really does blow you away. The one that Helen's talking about is pretty spectacular, but I find it difficult, even with the really good 3D, to wrap my head around what's happening. I feel like Inception does repeat the sort of motif of gravitational sort of shifts throughout the movie, and the different layers. It does make sense. It's weaved into the plot, and the Isha inspiration. I mean, you can see from the way that this movie was originally has been sold through the trailers that there is a lot of Christopher Nolan, the Batman Begins in there as well, and a lot of Inception. That I agree with you. That doesn't put you off seeing it, because it's very much its own thing. I did feel like sometimes the VFX can be somewhat overwhelming in these Marvel movies. I almost always enjoy the first half more than the second half.
I think this is interesting, because something like Civil War, for me, I much preferred the characters to the fighting. I thought the fighting was excellent, but I was actually there for those characters.
Right.
And in this case, I was actually, if anything, I was a little bit let down by the characters.
Really?
Not to a huge extent. I think there's a lot of potential there, and I could absolutely grow to love them in future films. But what this one did right, I thought, was all those kind of the spectacle.
I agree that the visuals are very much his forte, and it is an incredible experience. You should see on the biggest screen you can.
Yeah, and in 3D,
I'm not trying to dismiss any of that. I really enjoyed it. I just find that Marvel movies are at their strongest with the character interchanges. They always have great actors.
Yeah,
they always have really well chosen actors. In this case, I think Tilda Swinton is fantastic. She brings her own energy to this film, which counterbalances what's going on around her and adds this sort of weird zen calm to the mayhem, which works perfectly. They're so well cast, and often the writing is so sharp, and there's a lot of great laughs in this. The little character moments between Cumberbatch and Benedict Wong, for instance, are the things that I enjoy the most. When you get into the final third and you have this big showdown between Cumberbatch and Mickelson, who I felt slightly poorly drawn, and his motives.
It's a great scene though, especially when Doctor Strange asks, "What attracted you to the project?" I agree with that. I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I one of the reasons that you and I love the Marvel Cinematic Universe so far is the character interactions. The characters are ones that you really, really love, and even in something like Ant-Man, which is a flawed movie, but those characters pop right away, and they're such so memorable. Michael Peña is great in that film. And I feel that this is probably more dominated by the central character than any Marvel movie since Iron Man.
I would agree with that.
And Cumberbatch, as I've said in the podcast, I was worried going into this. I wasn't entirely convinced, but he's very, very good in this and does convince me. But I think it's to the detriment of the other characters, that the other characters don't quite pop and they don't quite sizzle and they don't quite work together as well as previous Marvel movies. But again, as you say, hopefully in future installments we'll get to know them a little bit better.
Yes. If you were to list the characters in levels of detail in how well sketched they are, Cumberbatch is, there's a big drop off. And then you have some of, Tilda Swinton and Baron Mordo, and then you have an inanimate
It's just Mordo.
Object.
There's no Barons.
No Barons.
So they're
Baron
honestly,
yet.
There's
my bad.
Baron Zemo, Baron Strucker, Baron Mordo in the comics. None of them are Barons in the films.
Okay.
What is Marvel going against Barons? It's a Baron spell, if you ask me.
Oh.
But then,
I've got to drop my microphone.
It would have really ramped things up if you'd felt like Mickelson and his hench people were given a bit more detail. Rachel McAdams, again, a bit more detail.
Oh, she's... Yeah, she is hugely,
she's a good actress,
badly
but, wow.
underserved. She
should
has
we,
nothing to do.
Should
yes.
we talk about this in the spoiler special?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes,
let's
absolutely.
Do this.
But anyway, we gave it 4 stars, and I would go along with that. It's a 4-star visual experience.
I think it's a 5-star visual experience, probably a 3-star story experience, and I'm happy with 4 stars in between.
I think that's a 5-star review. You're a 3-star.
Yeah, it's a fine, solid addition to the MCU. It is not as good as Civil War, I would say. But it is a very entertaining blockbuster indeed. So 4 stars for Doctor Strange. And also up this week, we have the South Korean zombie smash Train to Busan.
Yes, this really, really, really impressed me. It is pretty much all there in the title and the sort of blurb. But a businessman takes his daughter on a trip to visit her mother. That's what she wants for her birthday. So he takes the morning off work to deliver her via this very normal, very familiar looking intercity train. And unfortunately, one of the last people to run through the doors as the train is leaving is infected with a zombie plague.
Oh, no.
Don't you just hate it when that happens? So that person obviously succumbs. There is no escape from such things. And very, very, very fast indeed, a whole lot of other people follow. I mean, think of the trains with the, you know, the sliding glass doors and the complete lack of zombie proofing. It's a bad, bad place to be stuck with a horde of ravening beasts. And that is the situation in which our heroes find themselves. So they're, I mean, they're kind of stock characters, but who cares? It's an amazing, amazing film. It's kind of, it's been described as, I think, The Raid, but horizontal, which is not unfair. Mm-hmm. It's been compared, obviously, to Snowpiercer, another great South Korean mm-hmm. train movie, equally fair. It is really good. And what's impressive is that they've actually found new ways to do zombies. So these are fast zombies, or infected, if you are still making that distinction. But it does certainly have shades of 28 Days Later. But they have some interesting twists that I hadn't seen before. And that makes it quite fascinating. So some of the ways that you can kind of get past them or get around them are genuinely fresh and genuinely interesting. And that was quite exciting to watch. It was a huge hit in South Korea. It deserves to be a big hit here. I believe it's on practically no cinemas up and down the country. So if you're not in London, it might be difficult to get to. But if you're a zombie cinema fan, you should definitely yep. seek this out.
Absolutely. Violent and funny and dark and surprising. And yeah, really great stuff. Four stars for Train to Busan. Also out this week, there's a group of films. Check the Empire website for full reviews and star ratings. We have the likes of Ethel in Earnest, which stars Jim Broadbent, Pam Ferris and Brenda Bleth, and we gave that 3 stars. There's also Starfish, which has Joanne Froggatt and Tom Riley teaming up. Check the website for a full review for that one. A reissue of John Singleton's fantastic Boys in the Hood as well, from the BFI as part of their Black Star season. So there's a lot of stuff to watch as well. Doctor Strange obviously came out in Tuesday. Once again, the spoiler special for that is going to be out on Monday, November 7th. Unless things change, do keep checking our Twitter feed, our personal Twitter feeds, as well as the Empire One, for any updates on that. And that's it for this week's Empire Podcast.
Hurrah.
Hooray.
Or boo, you know.
Whatever. Or boo. It's up to you. Yeah. It's entirely up to you. But I think the people at home, I think I know where they're going.
Hurrah.
Join us next week for more film-related fun, when we'll be joined by the director of The Light Between Oceans, Derek C. in France. So all very interesting indeed. Until then, it is goodbye from Phil.
Goodbye.
It's goodbye from Helen.
Toodaloo.
And I'm off to get my box set of The Great Bulgarian Existential Bake Off. See where Sean Paul is doing. This week he's putting wine into a Victoria sandwich. Is it going to work?
Probably not.
No.
Yeah. Sommelier de glove. That's what he says.
No.
No. Hang on.
Maybe if you made like a syrup with the wine and poured it over the top of the sponge.
Do you think?
Yeah.
That might work. The sweet sommelier of success. See you next week. Bye.